We are Radio Catskill.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, a fire at the former Nevely Grand Hotel is under investigation. The Nevely was one of the many hotels in the so-called Borscht Belt that for decades drew thousands of visitors to the Catskill region. The fires interrupted conservation efforts by the Borscht Belt Museum. They've been actively working to salvage items from the hotel for preservation. We speak with Andrew Jacobs, the co-founder of the Borscht Belt Museum. And from West Point to Ukraine, the journey of Colonel Sam Hartwell, a former U.S. Army military intelligence officer and West Point graduate, who's dedicated himself as an unpaid volunteer to aid Ukraine's most vulnerable populations, including veterans, folks with brain injuries, amputees, and children in special needs. Patricio Rubio speaks to him. But first, the news from NPR.
Our news in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Authorities in Baltimore say six men who are missing from yesterday's interstate bridge collapse are presumed dead. Searchers are still looking for their bodies near the port of Baltimore. The Francis Scott Key Bridge fell after a fully loaded cargo ship struck one of its supports. The chair of the National Transportation Safety Board, Jennifer Homendy, says officials have gotten a key data recorder off the ship.
We do have the data recorder, which is essentially the black box. We've sent that back to our lab to evaluate and begin to develop a timeline of events that led up to the strike on the bridge. And we hope to have that information to share with the public later today.
She spoke to CNN. The ship had apparently lost power when it crashed into the Key Bridge. It took seconds for much of the bridge to give way and plunge into the water. Today marks the first anniversary of the Nashville, Tennessee school shooting that left six people dead, including three children. From member station WPLN, Rose Gilbert reports the tragedy has left a lasting mark on the region.
The Covenant school shooting last year was an earth-shattering moment, provoking waves of grief and outrage across Middle Tennessee. It also brought new urgency and new people to the local gun reform movement. People like Sarah Shoup Newman, whose eldest son is a student at Covenant. Over the past year, she has become a fixture at the state capitol, attending committees, tracking bills, and meeting with legislators.
I've told people my eyes have been open to things I didn't want to realize were going on, and I wish I could close them, but you can't, because now you have a responsibility.
Newman plans to commemorate the day by attending a private memorial service, and then, later, joining a demonstration at the Capitol. For NPR News, I'm Rose Gilbert in Nashville.
Stocks open mixed this morning amid continued enthusiasm for Donald Trump's social media company. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped about 280 points in early trading.
Stock in Trump Media and Technology Group continues to climb after jumping 16% on the company's first day of trading. That put the value of the former president's stake at more than $4.5 billion. The rise is fueled more by political passion than economic fundamentals. Trump's social media platform has yet to generate any profits. Visa and MasterCard have agreed to settle a long-running lawsuit over fees that merchants have to pay to process credit card transactions. The deal would temporarily freeze swipe fees just below their current level, which average about 2.25%. A coalition that's been battling swipe fees says the settlement doesn't go far enough and vows to continue to push for a congressional fix. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On the stock markets, they remain mixed this hour. The Dow is up about 280 points. The Nasdaq is down about 25. This is NPR. Officials in Qatar say talks continue at a technical level about a potential ceasefire in Gaza and a deal to release hostages held by Hamas. Israel's prime minister is rejecting new Hamas demands for a ceasefire longer than 6 weeks. Israel's defense minister has completed meetings with U.S. officials in Washington. The U.S. officials insist Israel should not stage a major operation in southern Gaza without a clear plan to protect Palestinian civilians. Republican U.S. Senate candidate Kerry Lake is asking an Arizona court to swiftly determine what damages she owes in a defamation lawsuit. This was brought by a local election official. From member station KJZZ in Phoenix, Wayne Shutsky reports Lake is apparently seeking to avoid a trial.
Maricopa County Recorder Stephen Richer sued Lake and her campaign after she made repeated claims that he sabotaged the 2022 gubernatorial election she lost to Democrat Katie Hobbs. He is seeking an order forcing Lake to delete false and defamatory statements and financial damages. Lake conceded legal liability for defamation in a motion in Maricopa County Superior Court. Richer's attorney, Jared Davidson, says Lake's concession vindicates Richer.
This is clearly an admission that Ms. Lake, her campaign, and her super PAC have no evidence whatsoever to back their false claims about our client.
Lake's attorneys denied that characterization in the court filing, and Lake posted a video claiming she is the victim of a political witch hunt. For NPR News, I'm Wayne Shutsky in Phoenix.
And I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. A fire swept through one of the buildings on the former Neville Resort property last week in Ulster County. On March 19th, the Winter Lodge building at the Neville Grand Hotel caught ablaze. Local officials continue to seek the cause of the fire. Thanks to firefighters, flames did not spread to the main high-rise building on the 463-acre property, but the Winter Lodge was destroyed. Tracing its origins back to the Borscht Belt era, the Neville first opened its doors in 1901 and closed in 2009. The fire has interrupted conservation efforts by the Borscht Belt Museum. The museum has been actively working to recover and salvage items from the hotel for preservation and display. Andrew Jacobs is the co-founder of the Borscht Belt Museum, and he joins us now with the latest. Andrew, good morning.
Hello, Tim. How are you?
Oh, good. Thanks for being here. So another hotel in the Catskill that went up in flames. How are these recovery efforts progressing in the wake of the recent fire? And even though this building had been sold and scheduled for demolition, the Borscht Belt Museum was working to salvage some of these items.
Yeah, I would say the fire has kind of helped hasten our efforts. We've been working with the property's owners, Somerset Properties, on extracting some elements from the building. To be clear, none of the things we were working on were in the Winter Lodge. Unfortunately, that building was pretty far gone by the time the fire started. These are items in the more modern parts of the hotel. So we are working on those with the Office of State Historic Preservation to, you know, first document some of them in place before we try to extract them.
And according to reports, firefighters from multiple departments in Ulster and Sullivan counties were on the scene from when it started Tuesday through Wednesday morning. The Ulster County Director of Emergency Services, Everett Erickson, says that no cause has been identified yet, but the fire's not being labeled as suspicious at the time. But it did, you know, it does impact what you're trying to do and what folks in the area are trying to do to preserve these memories of these hotels.
Yeah, I mean, not helpful. You know, the problem with the Neville property, and I think it's similar in a lot of these abandoned hotels and resorts, is that there's a lot of trespassing going on. There's a kind of a whole sort of movement of people who explore ruined abandoned properties and post them on social media. And you also have people who fly drones through the hotels. There are people who ride ATVs across the property. You know, it's not hard to break, get through the fence there. And unfortunately, there's a lot of vandalism. And I think, I would venture to say, you know, people just having fun, and that particular building was a big pile of wood, really, and easy target for vandals, and I assume that's what happened, but I don't know for sure.
Right, there's no official cause of how it happened, but you're right, there are a lot of trespassers in these hotels. Is that a challenge for your efforts as well, as you try to recover and salvage items from these iconic Borscht Belt hotels for the museum?
Yeah, it really is, and it's worrisome, because obviously we can't be there, or no one can be there all the time to safeguard these sites. And there is some real value in what's there, but it just takes time, and there is a process for removing them. So it is worrisome, and we are trying to work as fast as we can so we don't run into something unfortunate like this.
Yeah, the Neville is actually the fourth Borscht Hotel to catch fire after closing and falling into ruin. Pine Hotel in Fallsburg burned down last June. Homowack Resort caught fire last July. And, of course, Grossinger's Resort in Liberty, which inspired the blockbuster film Dirty Dancing, destroyed by fire in 2022. What does this feel like for you as the co-founder of this museum trying to preserve this heritage, seeing these hotels go up in flames?
It's pretty dispiriting. You know, on one level, it's kind of symbolic in a way, because most of these properties are so far gone that there's, you know, very little left to save. There's a lot of people who've gone through the hotels and are moved items of value. You know, they have been stripped clean, you know, the copper pipes, electrical wiring, you know, it's been years of people going in and taking what they want. So in some sense, these fires are just sort of more of an emotional gut punch. On the other hand, in the case of the Neville, where we are actively working to save some of these pieces of history, it's not good.
What are some of the pieces of history that you're able to save?
So the one that's proving the most challenging is in the Neville lobby. There is this double height, I would call them a bas-relief or a sculpture, a wall sculpture that extended from the ground floor up. It's a very sort of almost sort of, I don't know how to describe this, all sort of neo-paleolithic modern interpretation of sort of cave paintings. And it's very, very funky. From the 60s. And at the time, it was painted a riot of different colors. Really, you can see it on, if your listeners want to see, on the National Library of Congress has a collection at John Margulies. And if you put in their Neville lobby, it'll come up and you'll see that. At the moment, the paint is all sort of faded away or being painted over, and it's white, but it's still pretty stunning. And then the other one other thing we're looking at is this a granite sort of sign, the entrance to the Stardust Lounge, which was the main entertainment room of the Neville, and that's something we're trying to get. And some of the railings, some of the balustrade railings. And then we're also actually on the search for, there was a brass plaque up in the tower that marked the room where President Lyndon Johnson stayed in 1966 when he came to Ellenville to dedicate a new hospital building and stayed there. And that plaque has apparently disappeared. But we were hoping someone who has it will turn it in. Because it has more value for in the museum than it does hopefully in somebody's living room.
Yeah, I've punched it up online. Is this the mural you're talking about? Is it the Atlas Obscura, the very very tall, like kind of like you said, cave like sculpture?
Yes, yeah, cave like. Wow. Yes.
It's very cool. So how do you go about trying to recover this stuff? Are you guys just in there with flashlights and shovels trying to dig through it because it's so dilapidated?
Well, you have – so the first step is working with the State Historic Preservation Office, and they require a 3D scanning of that. And so that's the part we're working on now. They just want to make – you know, they want to document it in place. Because it just, for obvious reasons, and, God forbid something happens as we're moving it or removing it, they want to know exactly what it looks like and its configuration. So that's the first step. And then we've had people go in and sort of try to figure out what exactly it is and how to remove it without destroying it. And that's been the other challenge. It's we haven't found a lot of records on exactly how it was installed. It seems to be a fiberglass or some kind of composite molded substance. And that's the other thing we're trying to figure out. So, but we are accelerating our efforts now, given the fire last week.
It's a time consuming effort. It sounds like an akin to an archaeological dig in some ways.
Yeah, for sure.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Andrew Jacobs, the co-founder of the Borscht Belt Museum. We're talking about their recovery efforts and the impact of the fire at the Neveley Hotel in Ulster County on those recovery efforts. Andrew, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we want to talk about some of the other developments and efforts that are going on at the Borscht Belt Museum as you get back into the season. We'll take a quick break and be back with Andrew Jacobs. This is Radio Chatskill.
Engineer Saad Bamla loves solving biological mysteries, like the strange way a bug in his backyard was peeing.
I was like, hey, there's something happening. There's a droplet at its butt, and it's flicking it. I was like, all right. Challenge accepted, bug.
Animal enigmas. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Friday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We're talking to Andrew Jacobs of the Borscht Belt Museum, dedicated to preserving the legacy of the Catskills Resort era and celebrating its history. We were just talking about the efforts that the museum is undergoing to help fast forward those efforts, I guess, to save some of the items from the Neveley Grand Hotel in Ulster County that was struck by a fire last week. Andrew, we're just a week out before you guys reopen again, April 4th. What do you guys have coming up?
So we are reopening the museum on April 4th with the same exhibition we had last summer called Vacation Land. And then in June, we are going to launch a new exhibition called and Such Small Portions. It's about comedy and food in the Borscht Belt Resort era, and that'll be a lot of fun. We're also launching a Sunday event series starting on the 7th of April, and expect really great events, talks, music, dance, everything starting. We got your next and every Sunday.
And you have, the last time you were here, we had you on with the New York Comedy Club about the comedy that's coming back to the Borscht Belt, Comedy Club.
Thanks for reminding me.
Yeah, April 27th at Shadowlands.
April 27th. Thank you for, we have a great show. These are all local comedians who are programming that show. That's, kick off our comedy series, which is at the moment it's monthly, but we're hoping to make it more, frequent. And we sold out our first two shows, which is a good, we hope a good omen for the success of the series.
Yeah. I mean, selling out first time out is great. And, you added another show and then that sold out.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
9 o'clock shows.
That happened. Yeah. I think that happened since we spoke last. So, again, what, how important it is to bring comedy back too. We were talking about the history and, the museum type items, but just the idea of comedy back in the Borscht Belt is really meaningful.
Yeah. I think it fits in with our overall mission, which is to sort of promote, and preserve and celebrate, stand up comedy and the role that the Borscht Belt played in its evolution in America. But it's also about bringing people back to the Catskills, and specifically in this case, Ellenville, which was, a resort town back in the day, and, sort of suffered when those resorts left. And so we're all about sort of enhancing Ellenville's role as sort of a regional cultural magnet. We've got the Shadowland Theater in Ellenville, so plus the museum. So we're, we want people to come back and spend time, and also see great comedy and promote local comedians and up and coming talent. So it's all about getting people to laugh.
Yeah. Much like our friends at Bethel Woods, they have an oral history project trying to preserve the memories of a particular time. The Borscht Belt Museum also has an oral history project trying to capture and preserve that history. Can you talk a little bit about the oral history project, how it works, and of course, why it's so important?
Yeah, so we launched that last summer in the museum. We have an oral history booth, and we collected about 50 oral histories over that last year. But then about a month ago, we launched a remote oral history project, and basically anyone who has a story to tell can do it from their own home. If you have a laptop or a smartphone and it connects to someone at the museum, set up an appointment, and we have half-hour slots, and we want to hear your stories. And why is that important? I mean, you know, we believe this period in history, the Catskill Resort era, is a really pivotal moment in American history that's been largely overlooked, and most young Americans don't have any idea about its existence at all. They maybe seen Marvelous Miss Maisel's or Dirty Dancing, and they have a vague sense. So we're really we're dedicated to preserving this history, and a key part of that is getting the stories of those who lived it. And, you know, that group of people are generally, you know, in their 60s and older. And it's, you know, we feel like it's pretty critical to move on this now and capture those stories.
Since you started last summer, is there any notable story or personality or character that stood out that you've heard so far?
Oh God, we had a woman, 101-year-old woman who is a dancer, in great shape still, and who told us amazing stories about performing the Catskills. A lot of great, waiter stories, a lot of humor. And what we love about this, what this project's bringing out on people is humor and joke telling. And, you know, if you just have a really memorable joke, that's enough. You know, we are happy to hear that and record those. And I think a lot of food stories, which has kind of inspired our upcoming show about food and comedy. And what we realize is that food was a huge part of humor back then, and still is to a certain extent. But so we're really, the exhibit will lean heavily on our oral histories. There'll be a lot of audio in the show. So come on down when we open, and you'll see it's going to be a really sort of entertaining and also educational.
You're also doing an online video interview as well.
Yeah, so these oral histories are both video and audio. People will experience them as audio only, but we do have that option if you want to see what the speaker looked like.
And as you said, you can do it in person or online participation. And how can folks learn more about what you guys are doing for the season, but also some of the recovery efforts we talked about and how to get involved?
Just go on our website, borschtbeltmuseum.org, and you can sign up for our newsletters where we send out regular dispatches on what's going on. And that's really the best way, borschtbeltmuseum.org.
All right. We've been talking to Andrew Jacobs, co-founder of the Catskills Borscht Belt Museum, and they're opening back up the museum on April 4th, next week. Thank you very much for joining us to tell us about how you guys are helping to fast forward that recovery effort at the Nevely and also some of the other great things you're working on over there.
Thank you, Tim, for having us.
All right. We'll take a break. And when we come back from West Point to the Ukraine, we'll talk to Colonel Sam Hartwell, who is a former U.S. military intelligence officer and West Point graduate, how he's dedicated himself to helping folks in the conflict. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org, and from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. This leaves most counties with little or no access to local news and information, and even more are at risk of losing their last local news source. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to this station.
Support the news and information you rely on. Donate now at WJFFradio.org.
So you've never donated to this station before. That's okay. Today is a great day to make your first gift. Here's how.
Give now to Radio Catskill at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The end of March this month will mark 8 months since the United States first requested supplemental aid to resupply Ukraine's armed forces and to help the country prepare for upcoming Russian offensive. With Congress beginning or in another recess, there might be an end in sight to the partisan logjam after they return. However, the conflict continues and lives are still impacted. Retired Colonel Sam Hartwell, a former U.S. Army military intelligence officer and West Point graduate, has devoted his life to deciphering the intricacies of international relations, with a particular focus on his experiences in the former USSR, where he lived and worked from 1992 to 2000. Since March of 2022, he's dedicated himself as an unpaid volunteer, collaborating with various NGOs to aid Ukraine's most vulnerable populations, including veterans suffering from traumatic brain injuries, amputees, and children in special needs orphanages. Radio Catskill's Patricia Rubio spoke with Colonel Hartwell to talk about his contribution on the front line of this conflict.
Delivering medical supplies to battalion aid stations, brigade aid stations, medical kits for the troops primarily, but a lot of other stuff too. But after that, I transitioned over to some other NGOs that needed help more, because that business was doing very well. So I got involved with some orphanage NGOs and raised money for a special needs orphanage up in the north, north of Kiev, that had been surrounded by Russian troops. And then also now, most importantly, I'm working for two NGOs that are serving Ukrainian wounded amputees and traumatic brain injured folks. And there's a lot of them. The amputee problem is severe. Here's some facts, the latest facts that I've had from a couple of months ago. There are about 1,000 amputee patients on average per month. That's not limbs, that's people. And these could be multiple amputees. I've seen triple amputees. In a very bad way. And it's not just that they've missed the missing limbs, but the rest of their body is scarred as well. And of those 1,000 on average, there's only 200 of them that can be taken care of by the Ukrainian medical system. And another 100 per month are taken care of by external sources, NGOs and governments. So that leaves an accumulation of about 700 of these guys per month. Now, on the traumatic brain injury, the TBI cases, these guys are getting hit in the front lines by 500-pound glide bombs that are coming from 20 kilometers away, and they're hitting positions, and you can imagine the overpressure of these things. And I'm seeing patients that had brain damage, brain operations, they're partially paralyzed, and they need the assistance even more urgently than amputees. And amputees, you can imagine, you can wait as necessary. But a traumatic brain injury needs to be dealt with right away, or those patients will just be stuck in that near vegetative state. But once you get them some therapy, they do make incredible progress. I've seen these guys after 6 months, one of them completely back to normal, basically, and others who have gone back to at least 50% normal. But the problem there is, as with amputees, but traumatic brain injury therapy it's at least $2,000 a month state-of-the-art hospitals. And so that's where we try to raise money for those guys. And the main vehicle, the main NGO for that, it's called Veteran Coalition International, vetcoa.org. And that's run by some fellow West Pointers. and I'm their local representative in Kia. So we're trying to raise money to support as many of those TBI victims as we can. So that's what I'm doing right now. And I would like some way at some point to help with money raising for those efforts. But I really don't know how to do that myself yet. We have other people working on that. But that's what I'm doing. Now, as for other issues, I'll let you take it from there. What issues do you want to talk about?
I'm still curious about your day-to-day operations when you're there. Many would choose safety when going to the war, but you sort of opted to be on the front line of the humanitarian aid of the Ukraine. So just explore more. What sort of drove you to do that? You said you were on vacation, hopped in your car, and made the trip to Ukraine. So what was the motivation behind that? I know you mentioned your friend who was also there. What motivated you to go from America to Ukraine?
Yeah, it was the urgent needs of a few friends who had immediate needs, getting the one family out. Plus, at one point, I was financially assisting in support of about five or six families. And then there's just other people that I knew that if I'm there, for moral support at a very minimum, it's important to them. But yeah, as an old Cold Warrior, I thought the Cold War was over. I thought we were going to be the best of friends. We did wonderful things to help Russia for the longest time. And now they've turned rogue against us. They killed one of my very best friends from West Point. So for me, the mission's not done. I have to go back. It's just part of my DNA. 30 years career soldier, active duty and reserve. That's why.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to retired Colonel Sam Hartwell, a former U.S. Army military intelligence officer who has been donating his time to help the humanitarian effort in Ukraine. When you went to the front line, what things do you have seen? You mentioned the amputees, mentioned the brain injuries you've seen there, but where were you staying? How was your sort of your day-to-day there? You're visiting patients, you're helping out with humanitarian aid. Where are you staying? How are you staying safe yourself?
Yeah, there's two aspects to that. When you're near the front line, if you're 20 kilometers back or 20 or even 30 kilometers back, there are little towns that have small hotels and have you managed quite well. They're very cheap. Of course, you can't, when we got to within 2.5 miles of the front line, you don't stay there very long. You drop things off and you move back. But we basically stayed in hotels in small towns and big towns that were back from the front line, anywhere from 20 to 50 kilometers. Granted, it's a war zone, but I don't want to make it too dramatic, but I understand the risk and I can see what's going on. And I think I can handle myself.
When first watching the war, mainly on social media, when folks were live streaming themselves, I knew someone who went to Ukraine, just happened to be in Ukraine, was live streaming a lot there. And it seems strange because we see the news of the front line, you see what's happening there, but then you see some towns and villages almost acting normal, going into stores and having hotels and things like that. Being here in America and watching that, it was like, wait, is there a front line? If not, but obviously it wasn't like the whole country was in its wakes of war. It was just at that time, specific plots of land, plots of sections of the country that were involved in the invasion.
Yeah, our journalists don't get anywhere near the front line. The Ukrainian journalists that I'd seen on Ukrainian TV are actually under fire. So the local TV is very graphic. We don't show that. And our guys, I've been through these villages that were liberated first by Russian so-called liberation. They're absolutely destroyed. They destroy everything. It's a genocidal campaign. They've stated, as they do now routinely, that there are no Ukrainian people. There was never a real Ukraine. They're just the little Russians, and they come in, they destroy the hospitals, they destroy the churches, they loot the cultural aspects and take them back to Russia right away. That's what Russian liberation looks like. And the stories that I've heard from the old lady down in Kherson, she was in her 70s, and Russians burst into her house saying, "We are here to liberate you." And then they shoot her husband in front of her. And then they go into the backyard and shoot her brother. That's what the liberation looked like. And then I drive through these villages that are absolutely flattened. I mean, it looks like truly what hell must look like. Hell on earth. And for no reason. You know, why do you destroy where, why do you shoot it where people live? It's insane.
And now, obviously, here in America, and you see what's happening in Congress with the debate on whether funding should continue for the Ukraine and them attaching it to certain bills. So it be involved in all the political minutiae that's going on in Washington, D.C. When you see things like that, what are your thoughts? Knowing that you've been there on the front line, knowing that the need that is needed there.
It's in the best interest of the United States to assist Ukraine, to allow them to survive in some form or fashion. We don't know how it's going to end up. If we give the Russians too much time and too little support, they could move all the way to the Dnieper River, which basically cuts the country into two-thirds, one-third. Now one-third occupied by Russia and then two-thirds by Ukraine. And what we've given them so far, and I was just looking at this in American Foreign Affairs Institute, AFI. They had a great article recently on what aid was given. The American aid so far is a total of $75 billion, okay? And $46 billion is military aid. And the bulk of that, 90% of that, is stuff that we don't need, don't use, and is ultimately destined for destruction, which costs a lot of money. So better to give it to a country that wants to be our ally. People don't realize that Ukraine fought with us in Afghanistan and Iraq. They are a fantastic friend who wants to be an ally. They would be a great bulwark against Russian aggression. They have a million people under arms in the country. 500,000 of them are already combat experienced. They're very savvy. They have an intelligence system that makes ours, it dwarfs ours, their capabilities inside Russia. And Russia is a country that is a sworn enemy of the United States. They want to take down NATO. They've interfered with our elections. They openly admit it, and they say they're going to keep doing it. For us to give Ukraine old equipment, it's great for us in so many ways. We don't need it anymore. It's paid for. We would have to destroy it anyway. They get to use it. And then when we replenish our stocks with the newer equipment, the newer missiles and so on, guess who benefits? The U.S. worker. And where is most of that? It's in Republican districts. So I don't get it. I really don't get it. It's clearly in our interest to help these folks help us. It strengthens the NATO alliance to have them involved.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill and Patricia Rubio's conversation with West Point graduate and Army retired Colonel Sam Hartwell about his humanitarian work in Ukraine. We'll take a break and have more of the conversation. This is Radio Chatskill.
There's always a story behind the music, how the song was written, why the song was written. I'm Kathy Geary. Join me for Now and Then. Now and Then, Saturday afternoons at 3 on Radio Catskill. Listen local. Heaven is
the life. Hi, this is Marco Werman, host of The World. Weekdays at 3, our newsroom connects you with events around the globe. Our reporters in the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia get to the heart of the day's news. We bring you international perspectives on issues worldwide and here in the U.S. It's 1 hour each day that broadens horizons and takes you beyond our borders. Join me on The World, afternoons at 3, on Radio Catskill.
You're with Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Let's continue our conversation. Patricia Rubio speaking to West Point graduate and Army retired Colonel Sam Hartwell about his humanitarian work in Ukraine. Colonel Hartwell works for three non-governmental organizations assisting Ukrainians impacted by the war with Russia and how he's trying to make a difference.
Welcome back to the Local Edition. I'm your host for this evening. How do you see the upcoming American elections potentially influencing the situation in Ukraine.
Yeah. I can only go by what President Trump has said to his closest advisors, and then I look at things that he hasn't said. He has told previous national security advisors that he doesn't give a crap about NATO, that he will not defend countries that don't devote 2% of their GDP to defense. He wants to unilaterally abrogate a treaty, a relationship that we've had since the end of World War II, basically, that has European and global security. And that is beyond me. That is not what presidents do. You can't just abrogate a security relationship because you don't like it. So that troubles me greatly. If he were to withdraw or try to withdraw from NATO or not support NATO, that encourages Russia. The next steps would be, if we allow them to win in Ukraine, then they go against Moldova, an aspiring EU country who's now thinking about NATO. Nobody knows where it is, but it's a little sliver, a tiny country of a million or so folks between Romania and Ukraine. They're done. Then the next move that Putin would make, as he said, that some of those Baltic countries are historic Russian lands. So if he made a move, for example, against Estonia, just as an example, maybe it's Lithuania, countries of basically 2 million people. If we're afraid to confront Putin now with such an enormous problem on our hands in Europe for the Transatlantic Alliance, for NATO, what would we do, or what wouldn't Trump do if a Baltic was attacked? I don't know. No one knows. And that's a huge risk to Baltic. And we do nothing. Then NATO's finished. NATO would do nothing. And Putin would suddenly have dominance, or near dominance, or let's say influence, high influence over Europe. And the transatlantic relationship would be over. And there was another very interesting comment that with Viktor Orban, who's another Putin acolyte. Hungary is really a Trojan horse inside NATO. Hungary is the only country left that still issues Schengen visas to Russians, which means a Russian can get a visa, come to Hungary, travel anywhere in Europe. And they're also the only country that allows golden visas, meaning citizenship, for Russians. It means you come in, you invest 1 million euros in an organization approved by Orban, you get citizenship, which means you're allowed to live anywhere in Europe. Perfect venue for channeling spies and other agents into Europe. So he's not our friend. And the reason I bring him up is because, again, when Trump was president and he had a security briefing from his director of national intelligence at the time, in the midway through the briefing, he says, "I don't need to hear that. I already heard everything I need to know from Orban." So if you're taking your intelligence cues from a Putin acolyte and not listening to your own intelligence people, as a professional intelligence professional, I that's very dangerous, serious problem. So no one knows what he'll do. And that for me makes him, I just can't support that. Now on the Biden side, I have plenty of criticism for that too. It's the policy of too little, too late in terms of support, and the lack of a will to confront Russia like we used to do during the Cold War days. It is the real problem there. It makes me wonder if those folks have learned anything from the Cold War. You go back and listen to Harry Truman, for example, talking about his experiences with Stalin, and Stalin telling him that he will only abide by his agreements if you make me, he told Truman. And that is a Russian mentality that exists today. We And we, since the Obama administration, there was the Budapest Accords, where we had signed the UK, the US, and Russia guaranteeing the sovereignty of Ukraine. Putin took Crimea, and we did nothing. We abrogated that agreement. We did nothing. There was no, our obligations, just nothing. That was the sign for Putin that he could take the next step, which he did in the Donbass. And again, there were some sham negotiations in Minsk I and Minsk II and so on, but it was just buying time for Putin to strengthen his army. And we saw what happened after that. I just don't think that this administration understands how to show strength. And we're so much stronger. We, the U.S. and NATO, are so much stronger than Russia. Putin is afraid of NATO, quite frankly. And the way that they keep us at bay is with these threats. It's bullying, talking about nuclear weapons here and there, which is, again, it's a red herring.
I just looking back on what I hear from the governments and from experts are saying that the doomsday clock has moved up and the threat of nuclear war. And for my opinion, this is my opinion, that I've seen the hesitancy from the government is because of that, because of the potential of nuclear war. What is your thoughts on that?
Yeah, Hollywood thinks that World War III is a nuclear exchange. I don't see it that way. But first of all, Putin, why would he even launch nuclear weapons against NATO or the United States? Why? I don't see any reason. As far as using nuclear weapons in Ukraine, if he was going to use nuclear weapons, he would have used them early on. And had he used them early on, I'm absolutely sure that NATO, United States, everyone would have said, okay, Ukraine, draw the line. We're going to have to settle with the Russians the way they wanted. But he didn't do it. Even when he was being defeated, he didn't expect that he would need nuclear weapons. He thought he was just going to walk in and people would welcome him in certain areas. Then the fight got tough. Then they started getting defeated everywhere around Kiev in the north, east, west. Kiev was almost surrounded on three sides. And then you had the incursions, deep incursions coming from the south and many deep incursions from the east. And then the Ukrainians started to defeat them. If he was going to use a tactical nuclear weapon, he would have used it right there. But he was warned early on by us that if there were nuclear weapons techniques used in Ukraine, that we would respond, that everything was on the table. Now, what would that have been? Very likely only conventional, only from the air, and only through naval and air means that we would strike Russian forces in Ukraine only. And furthermore, the Chinese told them that that's unacceptable for them as well. They would have to back away. Because what happens if you use a nuclear weapon to Russia? Immediately the next day, we're going to shut off all access to international money flows, first of all. There would be an immediate embargo of Russian oil, not just cutting out, just an embargo. And no exports or imports would flow. Immediately, governments at the executive level would cut off all access to economic support to Russia. And then what would happen inside Russia? The place would collapse. So no one wants to gamble like that. Remember also that Putin controls about $200 billion in assets. He has six or seven children, two daughters from a first marriage, and now three sons and a daughter from his girlfriend, for lack of a better word. He loves his family. He wants to go down in history as Vladimir the Great. You don't get there by using a nuclear weapon. It is bluster designed to scare the people in our countries, because the leaders, the people who know the military, are not worried that he's going to use a nuclear weapon. The worst thing that he could do on the nuclear spectrum is there's a major nuclear power plant in Zaporizhia, that's southeast Ukraine. Right now, it's not producing anything. It was the largest electricity nuclear power facility in Europe. It produced 30% of Ukraine's electricity, which was mostly for export, by the way. Electricity was a major export for Ukraine. But if they were defeated, I understand that the intelligence community was worried that he would create basically a dirty bomb situation. But again, that's stupid, because any nuclear act on Ukraine affects Russia. Let's not forget, the prevailing winds are east. So why would you use a nuclear weapon on your doorstep when the wind's blowing in your face? I don't get that. You have to respond to them firmly when they talk about nuclear weapons. And I don't see a response from this administration. They sound weak to me, and I'm sorry to have to say that, but I need to be blunt sometimes.
No, I haven't been on the front line. You mentioned NATO. Has NATO been pulling its weight in support of Ukraine, in your view?
I'm glad you asked that. There's two things to clarify. First of all, it's not NATO per se. It is NATO member countries that are individually supplying things, whether it's a Baltic country, the Netherlands, Denmark, Poland. These are the countries that have really stepped up, along with the UK. Great job. And I told you about the article that I just read. I can share that with you, and you can put it on your website from the American Foreign Affairs Institute. I just found an analysis from a Turkish English news outlet, which is extremely detailed. I can provide that to you as well. Very well documented on European support. As I said, the Americans we've donated, I think it's about $75 billion in total support, about 45 of which is pure equipment and ammunition and so on. The Europeans have donated $145 billion in financial support and military support. And this article details it country by country, exactly what they've given in terms of weapons and money. Now, money is important too. Money goes to the general budget, which pays for doctors and teachers and the important social infrastructure that keeps society together. We've done a lot of that, but the Europeans have done a lot more, and they're going to do more. And that's really where they are stronger than we are. They have more financial capability than we do. We have the military gear and a lot of it in excess, and that's where we do our heavy lifting. But in terms of, let's call it the NATO members versus the United States, $146 billion to $76 billion, it's a pretty good contribution. And my Ukrainian friends asked me to remind President Trump, and I said, yeah, President Trump doesn't want to support any NATO country unless they invest 2% of their GDP into defense. And my Ukrainian friends say, please tell Mr. Trump that we spend 22% of our GDP on our military just to survive. So good lesson there.
We were talking to a retired Colonel Sam Hartwell, who was a former U.S. Army military intelligence officer, who is now making his way to Ukraine, has been to Ukraine, and supporting with the humanitarian efforts there for veterans, traumatic brain injuries and amputees, and children in special needs and orphanages. Thank you so much, Colonel Hartwell, for talking to me and letting us know what you're doing in Ukraine and how folks can help.
Thank you very much. I live in Ukraine, and I'll be there until this is over. Thanks.
And that is Patricia Rubio from the Local Edition speaking to Colonel Sam Hartwell. The State Department has a fact sheet on how folks could help with humanitarian needs of the people affected by the Russian aggression in Ukraine. It's at travel.state.gov. This is Radio Chatskill. And before we go, just enough time to remind you of what you should do about the eclipse if you want to observe it. Eye doctors are cautioning everyone to do their viewing safely. It will be a sight to see. Jessica Kane with the New York Public News Network has some advice.
Dr. Robert Fechner has a stack of eclipse glasses in his office. As professor and chair of ophthalmology and visual sciences at Upstate Medical University, he wants to make sure the people around him will be viewing the upcoming solar eclipse safely.
We love watching interesting things. This is truly a miracle of nature, and it's really, really dangerous to watch it without proper eye protection.
Fechner says the eye has a lens in it to focus light, and focusing on an intense light like the sun for a long time in one location can cause a burn to the eye's retina. Because the retina does not have pain sensors, people likely wouldn't notice the damage before it's too late. But Fechner says that doesn't mean you need to skip the big event. He recommends wearing certified eclipse glasses to watch, or even focusing on the effects of the eclipse by putting your back to the sun and using a little science.
A simple thing to do would be you poke a pinhole, or ballpoint pen tip is actually a good size, poke that in a file card or something, then hold a piece of white paper behind it, and the circle you see is actually the projection of the sun. So as it starts eclipsing, you'll see it's no longer a circle. You'll see that shadow of the moon coming across the circle of your pinhole projection.
And if you can get the timing just right, Fechner says there is a window to watch an incredible event.
There is a moment where it is safe to take off the glasses, and that is totality. When the moon is completely blocking the sun, you can look and see the corona around the moon, and there's just nothing like it.
Fechner stresses it is not safe to look at the eclipse through telescopes or binoculars, even with eclipse glasses. And keep an eye on kids to ensure they're using protective eyewear correctly. In Syracuse, I'm Jessica Kane for the New York Public News Network.
And that's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Tomorrow, Deborah Warden from Action Toward Independence and NACL Theater's public workshop about media and technology literacy. That's tomorrow morning at 10. Be sure to listen to the local edition tonight at 6 or stream it online at wjffradio.org. And you can hear all of our local programming at our website, wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Furniture Restore, located on Main Street in Jeffersonville, specializing in antique and vintage furniture, rugs, art, and lighting, because buying well-made and pre-owned is a better choice for the planet. Winter hours online at therestorejville.com. And from The River Reporter, the community newspaper serving four counties along the Delaware River in Pennsylvania and New York, riverreporter.com. And from listeners like you.
Hey, it's Marielle Segarra, host of Life Kit. Spring can be a great time for cleaning and reorganizing after you finally put your winter clothes away. It's also a perfect time to take stock of what's important to you, like the news and podcasts you rely on from this station. Help keep them going by making a gift today. Here's how to donate, and thank you.
Go to WJFFradio.org and support Radio Catskill's Spring Fun Drive. That's WJFFradio.org.
Thank you for all the ways you help WJFF Radio Catskill. Your support sustains the news, music, and local voices that make up WJFF. It's only possible because of your generosity. Help keep it going. Consider signing up to be a sound supporter to make sure Radio Catskill has your constant support. Go to WJFFradio.org. And thank you for supporting public radio in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania.
This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, a thick cloud cover, a passing shower or two, a high of 46. Tonight, clouds sticking around, a low around 40. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, a little rain clearing tomorrow night. Tomorrow's high near 50, the low Thursday, 28. And looking ahead to the weekend, it's like partly sunny but breezy, high near 48 to 50. On Point is next.
Radio Catskill supporters include SUNY Sullivan, a community college in the Sullivan Catskills focused on preparing students for the future. More information at sunysullivan.edu. Livingston Manor, dining, shopping, and the arts at the gateway to the Catskill Park. LivingstonManorNY.com. And listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello. Radio Catskill. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania.